Subcommittee on Health Policy to order, and I would like to open a public hearing on House Bill 3093. Rick, what do we got?
Thank you, Chair. House Bill 3093 is a bill that requires the Department of Human Services to adopt a Bill of Rights for residents of patients of long-term care facilities, that these rights have to be in addition to existing rights, and then stipulates at least three things that must be in those, including care from trained staff specific to a resident's disease or condition, assistance in medication management or administration, and then that the rights include people who may receive modified or special diets that meet the person's specific needs. In the background, I did list the ORS 442.015.22 that defines long-term care, and then in the next page or two, the actual rights that are referenced in the bill. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Rick, and thanks for the additional info in the background piece. And I'd like to do this bill in about 45 minutes, so we have about nine folks signed up, so if people can be on task. If you have written material, please bring it up. First panel is Jim Davis, Karen Anderson, and Helen Mason.
I'll go ahead and Helen, I'll take a few minutes to get up here, but I'll go ahead and start. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Jim Davis, and representing Parkinson's Resources of Oregon, Oregon State Council for Retired Citizens, Save Oregon Seniors, and United Seniors of Oregon. And we urge the committee, the subcommittee, to support House Bill 3093. And in this bill, it would direct the Department of Human Services through statute and rule, which we'll explain in a minute, within the Senior and People with Disabilities Division of DHS. It would amend the Bill of Rights for residents of assisted living, residential care facilities, adult foster homes, and nursing homes to provide three things. One, the right to receive care from staff that are trained to provide care that is specific to the resident's disease or medical condition, and where the facility has agreed to provide assistance with the resident's medication management, the right to obtain assistance from staff with the administration of medication that meets the specific requirements of the resident's disease or medical condition, and number three, the right to be provided a modified special diet that meets those special requirements as well. So this bill addresses three critical issues for Parkinsonians, and our witnesses will give you the details of that. But it's staff training on these disease-specific areas and the administration of time-sensitive medications and special diets, which are critical to Parkinsonians. We had attempted to get these recommended changes into the DHS SPD administrative rules process, and we sat through many, many hours of meetings. And out of it, we got only very minimal changes because they weren't terribly interested in putting together disease-specific language in the rules. So that is why we decided to take a legislative approach to this and amend the Patient Bill of Rights in nursing homes, assisted living, adult foster homes, and residential care facilities. Now, nursing homes and adult foster homes, our Bill of Rights are in statute, but the others are in administrative rules. So our bill, as it has been written, is kind of taking that into account. But we did want to make you aware of the fact that it came out of legislative council totally different than what we wanted. This is not the bill that we actually put together. We wanted it not to just apply to nursing homes. We wanted it to apply to all long-term care facilities Bill of Rights, and that's how it was always intended. And so we have put together a... one of our legal beagles, elder law attorneys, has put together a recommended amendment that would incorporate those back in. But I know that Meredith Cody has been talking with us about even more streamlined language that we could potentially use. But just so you know, that our intent is to reach all four long-term care facility systems. So we would urge you to support House Bill 3093 and the expansion of long-term care Bill of Rights training to, or Bill of Rights to include training, administration, administration of medications and special diets that actually meets the resident's specific medical condition, and in our case, of course, emphasizing Parkinson's. So thank you very much. If you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer.
Jim, if I could, so this document that you gave us, it's a complete replacement?
Yes, I mean, I believe that it is, and just so that you know, and there could be even easier ways of doing it, our intent is to make this bill we just want to change, add those three areas into the Bill of Rights of all four facilities. And so we could probably do it more simply, and I think Meredith is going to help us with language, where that is just our intent, that first paragraph, those three points in all three bills of rights. And so however the language is worded to do that most expeditiously.
Thank you. Next. Karen or Helen?
Okay, I'll go.
You probably have more questions, but keep going.
I agree with her. Thank you, Helen. I'm Karen Anderson. My husband, Roger, came with me today. 2006 was the most horrifying year I had ever spent. We spent over 90 days in a hospital, either a skilled nursing facility or rehabilitation facility. It's frightening to find out that people knew very little about the timing of Parkinson's medication and the food interaction. It just shocked me, I guess, that he was, at some point, he was so bad he could not participate in any kind of physical therapy. He couldn't feed himself. He couldn't turn the remote control on the TV. Couldn't dress himself, do anything. And I was there with him 12 hours a day. Actually, I had probably my whole story is in a book that you've got. Yes. And I don't know. I'm just surprised. I mean, when he got to get his medication, I had to actually hunt down the medication manager, who was either in a meeting or changing shifts. They were not familiar with what a Parkinson's medication looked like or really how it affected Roger. And I stayed with him a lot, and he begged me not to leave him. He thought at one time that they were actually going to kill him. And he was going to die. And we had our pastor come, and it was pretty upsetting. All I know is I just feel that we need to do something. I don't want him ever to have to go into a long-term facility ever. This is no different in a hospital either, by the way. But it seemed to be, it escalated in the skilled nursing facility, which ended up him back up in the hospital again. So all I really wanted was the very best care for him. And I hope it never happens to you. And I'm sure if it was your husband or wife, you would certainly want the same thing. Yeah.
If I speak and don't read, I'll cry. I do that just talking to people, so that's one of my problems.
Introduce yourself.
I'm sorry. I'm Helen Mason. My husband retired from the Navy, and I also served as a Navy nurse. And I retained my California nursing license. My husband had Parkinson's, and he spent time in two Oregon hospitals, two long-term facilities, the VA and a hospice facility. One of my family members, and I have five children, and myself spent nights with him every night. And the care we found in the hospitals and the VA was great, but the care in the long-term facility was terrible. At times his Parkinson's meds were not given on time. That just seemed to be the way it was. His Parkinson's patients with Parkinson's disease need to have medications on time or their Parkinson's symptoms will be exacerbated. These symptoms may include drooling, confusion, frustration, stiffness, hallucinations, falling, inability to speak or swallow, and other symptoms depending on the patient. One evening while at the first long-term care facility, thinking it would be okay if I left him for a few minutes, I went out to my car to find a book that I had brought with me and forgotten. And when I returned, I found my husband walking down the hall in the nude, no clothes, nothing, and no care provider in sight. My husband was incontinent much of the time due to this, his skin broke down, causing lesions on his buttocks. I was unable to change the bed by myself, and finding a staff member to assist me was difficult. The call button was frequently unanswered for long periods of time, and sometimes not at all. In the second facility, I would stand in the hallway at night, hoping that the only CNA, a certified nurse assistant, on night duty. One nurse, the facility had three pods. The RN sat in the middle, and then the three pods. There was one certified nurse assistant on duty at night, and she had to take care of all the pods. Sorry, I was sidetracked. As far as I told you about the pods, again, the call button was often not answered. That was disturbing. I used to have to stand in the hall and wait to see, because I couldn't leave the room, wait to see if I could flag down the nurse assistant, who was very busy. It wasn't her problem. It was the facility's problem. One time I asked one of the nurse assistants what she knew about Parkinson's disease, and she said how I learned about Parkinson's disease, that when I was at school, there was a big bowl, and all the diseases were put into a bowl on a piece of paper, and it was up to us to take one of the pieces of paper out and to give a report on whatever the disease was. I did not learn about Parkinson's disease. I had asked somebody within the state for a review of the second facility, and she very nicely saw that I received the review. There were 50 pages of discrepancies, two columns, 50 pages of discrepancies, and the second column was supposed to be what was done. Well, there were some of them were absolutely empty. There was a situation where this Parkinson's gentleman did not get his meds on time, and he called 911, and the police department came, and they took his phone away from him because they didn't want that kind of a thing to happen. I personally feel the staff is not adequately educated or trained for specific diseases, is underpaid, and is required to be responsible for too many patients. In this, the care you would like is, I wrote on there, is this the care you'd like for your loved ones? I don't think so. I met a woman. This was just 3 weeks ago. I met a woman at my exercise class, and I asked her if she was a widow, and she said yes. And I said, what disease did your husband have? And she said he had Parkinson's disease. So I thought, oh, a soulmate. And she said, I said, how was the care? And she said, it was despicable. And I said, I had the same experience. And she said, but I bet you didn't take notes and take pictures. She was out of money. And I said, are you coming tomorrow? And she said, no, I have to work. And I said, what do you do? And she said, I clean houses. And I said, how old are you? And she said, 79. And it takes me 2 hours to get to my job and 2 hours to get home. So that's my story. I just kind of feel that we really have to get on this. Parkinson's disease is escalating. And so many of the patients, so many people have Parkinson's, and they will not, quote, come out of the closet. They're afraid of their jobs, and they're afraid that people will look at them strangely. So I have nothing else to say, and I'm sorry that I cried.
Well, no reason to apologize. Karen and Helen, thank you very much for being here and sharing your personal story. Questions for the panel? I guess I have one just kind of demographic question, if I may. The extent of Parkinson's in the aging community here in Oregon, I'm just trying to get a sense of the magnitude of the
problem.
Just curious if you have those. You might not have that.
Yeah, well, actually, in my compatriots and the second team is going to have a lot of that data and what we'd be able to give you. More often than not, Parkinson's affects the aging community. I mean, it is an older grouping, but it also affects younger people as well. As an example of the baseball player who played for the Portland Beavers and ultimately had to retire because he had Parkinson's. It really is an intergenerational disease. But I would, and ask our experts for facts, but it does affect the aging population more disproportionately. And also, interestingly, affects this part of the country more disproportionately. And people don't quite understand that either. But Oregon in particular, and we can ask our experts as well, but Oregon in particular has some of the highest rates of Parkinson's anywhere in the country.
Thank you, Lauren. We have most. I'm sorry. We have more Parkinson's patients here in Oregon than any other state. And we don't know why. We don't know if it's environmental. We don't know if it's farmers that are getting it, but we do know that we have more here.
Actually, Roger was 47 years old when he developed Parkinson's, and there was no history in his family. And he didn't get it really until he moved to Oregon. And so there's definitely a connection.
Thank you. Thank you for the clarification. Well, let's go up the next panel then. We have Meredith Coat, Steve Baker, and Holly Chamoff.
Hi. You did a great job with my name. Thank you.
Okay.
I'm Holly Chamoff. I'm the Executive Director for Parkinson's Resources of Oregon, and I want to talk a little bit about the demographics you asked about that. The statistics and incidence rates, so we're looking at incidence, how many people within a given population will develop Parkinson's disease. The older you get, the higher the incidence rate. 85 and older, we're looking at about 10% of the population with Parkinson's disease. And Parkinson's is not something that, unfortunately, doesn't make you immune from any other ailment or disease. Looking at the 65 and older population, anywhere from 1 to 3% of the population has Parkinson's disease. So, you know, the incidence increases dramatically with age, but as Jim mentioned in the earlier panel, it's not a disease that young people are immune from. We work with clients as young as in their 20s who have been diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, and that, you know, obviously calls to mind a whole host of other issues for young families dealing with a disease that everyone thinks just happens to old people. How those numbers translate back to Oregon, we estimate between 15 and 20,000 patients with Parkinson's disease, and that's just taking those incident rates and applying them right back to census data for the state. It's hard to know exactly because Parkinson's is not a trackable disease. You know, there's no, when you're diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, there's not a report that's issued to the CDC with one more tick saying another case of Parkinson's. Looking at how many people with PD are interested or candidates for long-term care, estimates are that about 20% of people with Parkinson's disease will end up in a long-term care setting. And it's hard. We've tried looking at how many people with Parkinson's live in a long-term care, you know, with any one care facility. And even talking to administrators, we'll ask, how many PD residents do you have in your facility? And it's the rare person who can give me an answer. I may know that there's 6 residents at least because of a support group that we have, and I know that 6 people are coming down the hall to attend that support group, and maybe the administrator will tell me 2 or 3. So even within the facilities, I don't think there's a good sense of having a good count that way. Does that address those questions about the demographics? I want to come back and hit a little bit more about the 3 items that are pretty critical to us, which is medication, timing, appropriate of diet, and caregiver training. But the medication timing, a Parkinson's medication schedule it can become very complex. And the optimum schedule for that individual is not something that came about as a result of a single visit to the neurologist. This ideal med schedule is something that has been developed and tweaked and fine-tuned over time to be the optimal schedule for that person given their set of situation and their symptoms. A med schedule for a person with Parkinson's disease has to happen on time. I mean, within just even a very short period of time, a person with Parkinson's, and Steve will tell you in a few moments, will have a very dramatic decline in their ability to function as their meds are wearing off. And what we're concerned about with long-term care is if there's a 2-hour window within which meds can be administered. So if your meds are due at noon, and if maybe you have a window between 11 and 1, for a person with Parkinson's disease, they don't have a two-hour window for their functioning. So, for example, if their 8 a.m. dose was an hour early and their 12 p.m. dose was an hour late, when their lunch comes at noon, they're likely not even to be able to function highly enough to self-feed. And so maybe their tray goes away full. Because their meds were not tweaked appropriately, they weren't even able to take in their diet and nutrition. So there's an issue with diet and nutrition that has to do with timing, but it also has to do with protein consumption with some of the more common Parkinson's disease medications. Having protein in the bloodstream can then bind up with the levodopa, leaving actually less available to make its way to the brain and do what it's supposed to do there. So it's for some people in particular, and bodies are different and people respond differently, but some patients really do find that by managing their diet and the timing of their protein throughout the day, that that they're able to really more closely manage their functioning that way. I'd be remiss if I didn't say that, we're not here to point fingers at any one institution or facility. I think that there's some great long-term care settings out there, and there are people that are really trying very hard within what they have to work with, but it's really not good enough, and for the majority of people, you know, we have a few stories, anecdotes that we shared with you today, but you know, in your packet I gave you a two-sided sheet of more, and if you want more I can keep them coming. You know, when we take hundreds of calls through our helpline, and when we hear from loved ones that have a person in long-term care, they have almost invariably an experience that they would be more than happy to share. Thank you.
Questions?
Yes,
Representative
Burns. Thank you, Matt. Thank you. Great testimony. This comes down just a basic ignorance of the disease to a degree, so a little bit along that path. How often or what percentage of the population of those with Parkinson's disease, and I realize that there is a spectrum, not only age, but in length of time that one's had it,
yes,
as well as maybe even severity of the disease.
Yes.
The question gets down to self-medication, though. Within those parameters, how often do people with Parkinson's disease self-medicate, and how often are they beyond self-medication to the point where we're talking about now where they're requiring to have somebody help administer or do the timing and everything else?
I think I'm going to be a little uncomfortable answering that. Most people, and when they're living at home, are able to self-medicate with some assistance. Now I'm going to pick on Karen and Roger, and hey, you know, Karen, who just testified, you know, Roger can take and swallow his own pills, but I think Karen oversees an awful lot of making sure they get down at the right time and actually getting his pill box filled. For people who may be starting to experience some cognitive decline, and that does happen for some people with Parkinson's disease, especially in later stages, they need a lot of assistance, full assistance. And one of the things that we actually become concerned about with, there become swallowing problems for people with Parkinson's, and even just dispensing, giving someone their meds, you know, there may need to be some, you know, follow through to make sure that they're actually ingesting the medication.
And one more follow-up.
Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. I appreciate that. And a second question comes, I wouldn't have been able to ask this question 6 months ago because I wouldn't have had this experience. I've got a 94-year-old grandmother that, unfortunately, she's going to see three figures, you know, I have no doubts. But we had to move her into and I always get the distinctions wrong, but I'm going to call it a assisted living facility, and I may be wrong about that. About 6 months ago or so, and she was having some real problems there. And the problems we discovered, we thought was great at first, and she was happy and doing great, and then we noticed some deterioration. The deterioration, after some analysis, turned out to be the fact that she was over-medicating herself. And so she doesn't have, thank goodness, she doesn't have Parkinson's, but she's old. Okay, so she has issues that a lot of people that hit their 90s have with the requisite medications. We discovered that the what we were paying for, our family was paying for, which was a lot of money by any objective measure, didn't include that necessarily, which was a sort of a day-to-day monitoring of medication. It was fine print, I mean, I'll give you that, but there was, for what we were paying for, truly black and white, did not include what we were hoping to get. So we've had to move her into, if you will, the next level up, which includes this monitoring of medication. And, you know, knock on wood, so far so good with her particular example. And so my question to you is, to a degree, and I don't want this to sound negative, but I'm being a little bit devil's advocate, are we asking folks in some of these assisted living, whatever we're calling them, are we asking them to do something that they weren't charged to do originally? I mean, with everything there is, a cost. If we're expecting treatment here, but we're only paying for this here, is that something that should have been predictable?
Well, you know, I may actually defer that and let Meredith help me out with that one when she gives her testimony. But certainly within nursing home care, expectation is that you're going to get help with your med management. I talked to a woman.
I know exactly what a nursing home does versus assisted living and all that. So.
Well, and it, just as another example that echoes your story, a woman here in Salem, his mother is in assisted living. Her mother gets a med pass 7 times a day, and the facility charges her $100 a month for each of those passes on top of what she kind of agreed for. So I think that, you know, in some cases that's just how the fee structure is set up. So for her, it's an additional $700 a month for where her mother lives to have the facility do the med administration.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Flores.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Chamoff, I think that probably you or one of your colleagues dropped off the information packets prior to it.
We've been busy this morning.
Yeah. And it's a good thing, good information. But one thing that caught my attention is that PD is caused by a deficiency in the brain of dopamine, a chemical which is essential for the normal function of nerve cells involved in the movement of body muscles. Now, having had the opportunity to hear a lot of testimony last session, serving on the Judiciary Committee in conjunction with the meth package, the impacted center in the brain is the dopamine center, and meth users, and I'm not suggesting that you're talking about using, I mean, we're talking about these folks here are meth users, so please don't misunderstand. I will get to the point. It's how it destroys that dopamine center, and I've heard subsequently that a lot of people who have been using meth and are even recovering or in their recovery are likely to have developing symptoms at some point of Parkinson's disease. So in the numbers that you've given us of 15 to 20,000 persons afflicted with Parkinson's disease in Oregon, do you have any sense of the numbers of folks who are senior in their years and developing it as opposed to those who have developed as a result of their use and abuse of meth?
It's an interesting question, and that's not something I'm familiar with. I would say that the statistics and the incidence data that we use to come up with our numbers are probably not greatly impacted by meth use or drug-induced Parkinson's disease. Although, you know, drug-induced symptoms, it does happen, but it's a different diagnosis than a Parkinson's disease.
Well, I mean, they do develop Parkinson's disease as a result, direct correlation to their use and abuse of methamphetamine. So, because their dopamine centers are thoroughly destroyed, and in recovery over a period of an extended period of time, it will redevelop, but they are at risk of developing Parkinson's disease.
It's a whole new wave of clients coming.
So obviously,
it's not something
you haven't dealt
with that,
and it's not necessarily factored into your figures.
Right.
Thank you.
Before we move on, I want to follow up to Representative Bruin's question around the type of facility. If the goal is to have these items apply to all long-term care facilities, I think we might have to consider which ones are more appropriate than others based on need for training and medication. So I just want to throw that out there. I thought that was an interesting point.
I think I've made my point, unless anybody has any other questions for me.
I would stay there. Thanks,
Helen. Okay.
Whoever wants to go next.
Can I talk a little bit? My name is Steve Baker, and I've had Parkinson's for about 7 years. I've never used meth.
You know I wasn't mean to you.
Noted for the record.
But I do have a substantial list of drugs that are all prescription. Not all prescription. Some are over-the-counter concoctions. But in addition to the normal list of traditional symptoms like tremor, I've got tremendous GI problems that I have to deal with. And I haven't quite come up with a combination of drugs that works real well, but my list includes Nurofen, amantadine, Sinemet, Prilosec, Tylenol, aspirin, Acefex, Motilium, Swiss Chris, Lactulose, Miralax, Zelnorm, Erythromycin, Cetogen, and Docusate sodium. And the disease is degenerative, so my list is going to be growing in intensity and variety. Hopefully there's new drugs on the market in the next couple of years that can reduce this list. But we're talking about care in long-term facilities. I was recently had so many GI problems. I was in the hospital for what I thought was a heart problem, but it was just upper chest pain due to GI problems. But they had to, for 24 hours, give me EKGs to prove that it wasn't a heart problem. And at 24 hours, Kaiser gives pretty good care. My meds were 3 hours late. I should have got them at 10, and I got them at 1 in the morning. And I said, before I checked into the hospital, I said, could I bring my own meds and administer them myself? And they said, no, you might get a double dose. We have to give them to you. So because I have one of my drugs comes only from Canada, the pharmacist came into my room and said, well, you're going to have to administer that one yourself because we can't get it. So as a backup, my wife bought all my drugs so I could have them if I needed them. I, for the most part, I took drugs that were administered by Kaiser, but I had a backup just in case because I've heard all these stories about people not getting their meds in institutions. So that's about all I have to say.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. Ms. Cote?
Chair Kotek, members of the committee, my name is Meredith Cote, and I'm the state long-term care ombudsman. And the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman investigates and resolves complaints made by or on behalf of the residents of long-term care facilities. We monitor the implementations of all laws, rules, and regulations as they affect the health and well-being of the residents, and we advocate for changes that improve residents' lives. And the whole notion of protecting residents' rights is very much a part of our mission. And I'm here today to support the addition of three new rights across the board to our four long-term care facilities. And I'd just like to put a little bit of perspective on what a resident's rights, what they are in terms of facilities and regulations. Basically, every type of facility has a list, a bill of rights for residents that is enumerated in either law and rule. And the reason for that is not so much that other people in the system, the providers, don't have rights. It's because residents so often are left out of the decision-making about their lives. And so this is an effort to put up front what a resident can expect in order to try to empower them. And so in the Bill of Rights across all facilities, we have basic rights like the right to be treated with dignity and respect, to have privacy when you're receiving treatment, the right to receive the visitors of your choice. But it goes on in terms of those rights because you'd be so surprised that people go into long-term care facilities and they don't understand that they have any rights. Some people actually think that they give up everything when they go into a long-term care facility. And the whole notion of rights is to firmly establish what you're not giving up. And so these three rights actually, to me, they make all the sense in the world because they are what everyone expects from a long-term care facility. And they're not just, although I realize that the previous people who have testified and the reason the bill is being brought before you is because this is about Parkinson's and the concerns they have, these rights would really affect all types of residents. And they're basic. You know, to receive care from people who are trained in providing the care about your disease. If you're an Alzheimer's resident and you have that disease, there's so much that people need to know about how to appropriately care for an Alzheimer's resident that makes the difference between a tragic end to your life and a life where you can thrive to the best of your abilities. And it all of that has to do with the caregiving. To be administered medications by facility staff according to what is prescribed by your medical condition. That's absolutely a common sense thing that most people expect. It's the reason that many people are in long-term care, and it applies, and the obligation to provide medication and management runs throughout the long-term care system, no matter what facility you're in. And the last one is to have the diet necessary to manage your disease or medical condition. Well, if the truth be known, nutrition is what, you know, we hear about it all the time, you know, how important. I mean, we have a whole program where we're looking at the kinds of foods that are appropriate for children and what should be in our schools. Well, by the same token, there are diets that are more appropriate for people who are managing chronic diseases. And people who go into long-term care facilities, for example, want to have that or need that kind of diet. For example, if one is a diabetic, there are foods that they shouldn't eat. Those foods should not be presented to them as their only alternative in their diet. For people who have other kinds of diseases, so the whole notion of getting the other very common one is people on low sodium, all the coronary patients and residents who are filling our long-term care facilities have to have low-salt diets frequently. The notion of these rights is, as I looked at it, for the most part, what is being required or what is being set out is required elsewhere in the rules and regulations. For example, every facility has to develop an individualized care plan for every resident, and that has to do a thorough assessment. Well, you can't decide how you're going to care for a resident in an individualized way unless you know something about their disease. So there is a requirement there in the law. The same about medications. They're supposed to be administered as prescribed, and the person administering them is supposed to know about any special instructions about the medications. That's in the rules across all care settings. And then the whole notion of facilities providing modified special diets, that is the lowest threshold of what is required across all types of facilities. So the problem with this is that so frequently long-term care facilities don't meet the requirements in regulation. And consumers of long-term care services frequently aren't familiar with the regulations, so they don't know what they're entitled to. In fact, you know, the two areas that generate the most complaints to our office are in the areas of medication administration and food service. So I guess the way I look at these three rights is that because providers are obligated under the rules to inform residents of their rights at the time of admission, by putting these into rights, you get information to consumers about what they are entitled to at the beginning of their stay in a long-term care facility. The hope that I have for that is that it will empower residents to speak out when some of their basic needs are not met. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cody. Questions? Representative Flores?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Cody, now you just mentioned that as ombudsman, you are the repository for complaints, and the ones that you primarily do regard medication and food service. Is that correct?
Representative Chair Kotek, Representative Flores, a large number of complaints, the two leading categories of complaints are medications. We handle any kind of complaint you might imagine and a considerable number, but those are the two leading categories.
Could you follow up? Mm-hmm. Thank you. And can you give us an idea of the volume or of complaints that you do receive from care facility residents?
Chair Kotek, Representative Flores, we probably on an annual basis probably work on a little over 4,000 complaints.
And follow up. And so then of 4,000 complaints, that's covering a spectrum of issues that people are bringing to your attention. And then can you give us an idea in the respective areas of medication and food service or nutrition?
As I recall, it's somewhere just under 500.
In the combined category?
Chair Kotek, Representative Flores, under about 500 complaints, just under about 500 of the combined medications and food service.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you. Thank you for your testimony, and thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And I'm going to call up the final three
folks that I have signed up. If there's other individuals who want to testify, please let Aaron know. We have Lauren Rhodes, Margaret Carley, thank you, and Linda Kirschbaum.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lauren Rhodes with the Oregon Healthcare Association, and today with me are two of my colleagues, Linda Kirschbaum, the Director of Assisted Living and Residential Care Facility Services for the Association, and Margaret Carley, who until last week was our general counsel for the past 15 years and is currently working on contract with us through the end of session. So I brought them with me because they're certainly better versed and knowledgeable about the issues that you've heard today, but I'm happy to answer any questions also at the end that we can do in follow-up. So thank you for allowing us to be here.
Thank you. I'm Margaret Carley with Oregon Healthcare Association, Representative Kotek Chair. I'd like to give some brief testimony, and it will be added to by Linda Kirschbaum on our staff. You know, we represent long-term care facilities, nursing homes, assisted living, residential care, and in-home care agencies. We don't represent adult foster homes. Those are homes, private homes, that have five or fewer residents in them. We also represent independent senior living. We obviously share the goal of the Parkinson's Resource Group of improving quality of care for persons who suffer with Parkinson's disease. In fact, prior to this bill, we met with them and gave them multiple collaborative ways that we could look at improvements in working together for the care of Parkinson's patients. In particular, we mentioned that we've worked nationally with organizations to develop guidelines and recommendations, and we have one for individuals with multiple sclerosis, and we have one for people with dementia that is a guide for the caregiver that is disease-specific information and how that impacts treatment. And we envision that something that we could do collaboratively would be to develop something similarly to meet an educational need. We don't believe that the proposals, though, are the appropriate means of improving patient care. Current federal state regulations governing long-term care facilities are sufficient to provide the rights of long-term care facilities. And we think that actually some of the rights in this bill would create negative policy implications, especially towards safe and effective medication systems, and I'll address that further in my testimony. Remember that there are different rules for nursing homes, which are regulated both federally and state, as for our community-based care facilities, which just have state regulations. And there's different level of services in each of the settings, and if you have particular questions about the settings, we'd be glad to answer that. The bill, as originally drafted, was defined only those long-term care facilities that are in 442.015, which are the nursing homes, and does not include assisted living residential. We will have some testimony about the current status of the regulations on those settings, though. What the bill proposes to do is to create three new rights. Now, remember, there's no additional protection associated with a right. If it's a regulation and a requirement, the facility has to provide it. Meredith argued that the creation of a right may provide some public information in terms of knowing that you have some ability to exercise these rights, but the facilities do have requirements currently. In terms of staff training, nursing homes use nurses who obviously have training in diseases. They also use certified nursing assistants. Our Oregon nursing curriculum is 150 hours currently. It's twice the federal minimum average, which is 75. It does include curriculum requirements for 14 diseases, including Parkinson's. You heard one example of where the training technique was to have each individual CNA research a disease and report on that. That's not the sole technique people use to teach about Parkinson's disease in our certified nursing assistant programs. We also have annual in-service requirement for our care staff that includes 12 hours a year, and in that, the in-services are supposed to address the special needs of the facility population. In nursing facilities, we have a minimum data set, which is a basic assessment, which would include information about Parkinson's disease completed on every resident. And if you ask the state of Oregon to pull the information on diagnosis, they could tell you to the number how many people have Parkinson's disease in long-term care facilities in Oregon. Generally, it's probably less than 3% of our overall patient population, just as a guideline, although it could obviously be higher or lower in any particular facility. We've also worked with the Board of Nursing to have some additional training for certified nursing assistants, and this is another option for the Multiple Sclerosis Resource Center. We worked for 5 years to create three additional levels of CNA training. One is devoted to dementia care, one is devoted to restorative nursing, and one focuses on the needs of patients in acute care. This is an additional voluntary training that sets forth both the curriculum and the competencies that are required, and it's our chance to educate CNAs about additional disease-based or population-specific needs through increased competencies and curriculum. And again, there's opportunities for the board in conjunction with a variety of people to develop additional training programs. The second right deals with disease-specific medication management. And we believe that there should be safe and effective medication systems. Linda and myself and the Department of Human Services participated in an AHRQ-funded grant where we actually developed risk models of all the medication errors in nursing facilities and community-based care and can statistically predict the type of risk and each of the things that may occur in order for that risk to occur in terms of wrong patient, wrong dose, omitted dose, and generally, we did not find problems with wrong time medication, which is what there was an interest in getting the meds at the right time for the purposes of the Parkinsonian clients. In fact, we found that if providers focused on the time of the medication delivery, that two-hour window, as it was called, and again, that's a survey interpretive guideline of what a medication error is, that people rushed up and sped up in the performance of the medication administration, and that was more likely to contribute to errors. A better approach would be to identify just those medications that are time sensitive and make sure those are administered in a certain time. But the way that the current right could be interpreted is that it's a resident's right violation if any med was administered 2 hours late, one hour late, and that could be like vitamins or all things that aren't very time sensitive. So I think that it would actually create more problems. There was a subsequent research study that was done, recently completed but unpublished, by Heather Young, who's a professor at the OHSU School of Nursing. She actually measured medication errors in assisted living facilities and found an error rate lower than in hospitals. She found that we did an excellent job in terms of medication administration. And she also looked at those meds that had common medication errors, and none of the Parkinson's-related drugs are on the list of medications that she frequently found for medication errors, and she did look at wrong-time errors, too. If you need more information, I can't release that much because it's an unpublished report so far, research report, but I recommend that you talk further to Heather Young, because again, if you focus on the wrong time issues, you will avoid some of the more serious issues. What we found is that it's more important to look at the identification of the resident and then also looking at the omitted doses issue in order to solve some of our medication safety issues. The last right has to do with a disease-based special diet. And again, there's a variation in our settings. In nursing homes, they're required to offer therapeutic diets. They have to have an assessment of the dietary needs. There's dietary orders. There's a dietitian who works with it. In community-based care facilities, this was one of the issues for the ALF and RCF rule group. And there was a decision that they would be able to use would be able to use your basic diets but not really complicated diets. So they could do a low-added salt diet, they could do a diabetic diet, but really highly complex diets, the assisted living facilities and residential care facilities don't have the ability to provide without, you know, additional staffing and dietitians and other things that the DHS decided that they didn't want to incorporate into the rules. So modified and special diets are provided in the regulations. But, again, there could be an interpretation that in all of the care settings, they'd have to provide very complex diets, for instance, in an adult foster home with a kitchen of five or fewer, establishing some milligram protein diet, they might not have the capabilities in order to provide that type of diet. We do want to work with the Alzheimer's Association, the Parkinson's Association in improving care, but we don't believe that the creation of these additional rights will actually result in improvements. And in particular, as it relates to the medication and management, we believe it will actually result in more medication errors because there'd be increased focus on the timing of the medications for all meds, not just those that are time sensitive. I'll leave Linda to complete the testimony, and then we can stop for questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and Chair Kotek, and the rest of the committee. Although the original bill does not have...
Announce yourself for the record.
Pardon?
Introduce yourself.
Linda Kirschbaum, the Director of Assisted Living and Residential Care for Oregon Healthcare Association. Although the original bill does not include assisted living and residential care, we do want to address those settings in light of the amendment. However, we have been working very diligently with senior and people with disabilities at the Department of Human Services on a major rule rewrite combining both assisted living and residential care rules into one OAR. And we have addressed staff training very specifically, and that includes very specific training on the specific disease populations specific to an individual community. So additionally, 12 hours of in-service education must be provided in those settings that are specific to the populations, which is a much more focused approach. So if you're dealing with dementia residents, you would focus on that specific population. However, all facilities would be required to address dementia in their staff training. And we feel that this is a beefed-up approach and very specific to the individual clients that a particular community is serving. We also added additional information on requirements on the medication administration record so that there are specifics if a medication has reporting requirements that you must report to a nurse if there are signs and symptoms, that those things are also addressed. I have to concur with Ms. Carley and her judgment in the timing issue. It's very critical that we don't create disincentives for people doing the correct thing with their responsibilities. What the OHSU study found, that the MedAids took their jobs very seriously, that clinicians that were consulted felt that they were doing an appropriate job and doing it well. So we want to further build on that work, and we think that building coalitions and educational guidelines and practice guidelines would be a better approach to improving this issue for Parkinsonian patients.
I just wanted to wrap up with a comment that in part relates to the questions that Representative Brune asked, and that is you will see also this session a governor's recommended budget proposal which would increase the minimum staffing for nursing facilities. And if there are additional resources that you would like to expend on long-term care facility, we think that would be a significant priority for you to look at. Secondly, we'd also be looking at reauthorization of our provider tax, which is funding a significant portion of our nursing facility rates. And you should also know that the assisted living facilities and residential care facilities are up for a cost of living increase, but the residential care facility rates haven't been updated for a number of years and do not reflect the new regulatory requirements that we're going to impose upon them. So to the degree you do add new requirements that relate to rights or medication administration or staff training, they should be funded in any bill that would proceed. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Carley, as you were talking about the second point in your written testimony pertaining to disease-specific medication management, you referred to an AHRQ that had been done, and I'm sorry, that just way over me.
Sorry, Chair, Representative Flores. The AHRQ is the Agency for Health Quality Research. This was a three-year study that we did in conjunction with the Department of Human Services. Grant Hingetson was the principal investigator on it, and we actually used what's called probabilistic risk assessment or social technical probabilistic risk assessment to create risk models of all the medication errors in nursing facilities and community-based care. The researcher that worked with us, Sharon Condon, is now going to team with Heather Young and use Heather Young's data to take actual data collection to plug it into our risk models to see if we appropriately predicted the risk. And those areas that we identified for high risk for medication errors are not related to timing. That's what I want to suggest. They're related to getting the medications to the right resident, dealing with the issue of omitted doses, and dealing with correct information in terms of pharmacy or faxing, so administration issues to make sure the correct information goes back and forth between the pharmacy, the physician, and the facility. And those are the issues that we should, if we want to reduce medication errors, focus on. If we focus on the wrong time errors, people were taking shortcuts to get their medications administered within that time window because they believed that the time window was more important than rechecking somebody's armband for identification, other things. And so the timing, the emphasis on the time part of medication administration actually encourages people to take shortcuts so they can complete the med pass. We also have data on how many meds per person, how many meds, and a significant portion. There's actually residents in assisted living are receiving more meds per patient than those in nursing homes, in part because they have multiple prescribers. So we'd be glad to provide you information. It's very difficult in a short period of time to describe this data. We did present the data to the RCF ALF work group as we address this issue of medication administration, and it is probably why the compromise was to say that there were specific instructions related to the administration of a particular med, like a Parkinson's med, that would be reported on the medication administration record, or MAR, and that was the compromise that was achieved in the rulemaking for the residential care and assisted living facilities.
Very, very interesting and quickly, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Well, if the discussion evolved to, well, there seems to be some shortening of the time frame in order to get through the med pass, what about the examples that we heard today where some people didn't get their meds till way after the time they should have received them?
Right now, there is the standard that relates to medication passes is, again, an interpretive guideline in the nursing facility rules that says if a med is not administered within 1 hour before or 1 hour after the scheduled time, that's considered a wrong time error if the error is clinically significant. And so that's the clinically significant piece is the part. Most of the timing errors have no clinical significance. With the Parkinsonian medications, it appears that the timing areas may have them. Heather Young didn't find that in her report, nor did we find that in our risk models. But based on the anecdotes that you've heard, there's a perception that there are some timing issues related to that. Again, there's a large volume of medications. There are a variety of solutions related to that. One would be to reduce the overall number of medications through a pharmacy review. Another would be additional staff related to who administers medications. There's also the whole variety of solutions that would address the timing issue, other than to say the solution is to administer the med on time, because given the resources, that may or may not happen.
Thank you for the clarification.
Thank you, Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Your answer spurred a question for me. If a med is considered to be given on time, if it's given within an hour before or an hour after the time that the medication is actually due, what happens if the medication on time is given an hour after it's due and in the next instance is given an hour before? Wouldn't it be very easy over the course of a 24-hour period where you're allowing a two-hour discrepancy to really throw off someone whose medications significantly impact their body chemistry?
Representative Gelser and Representative Kotek, it may be possible. The determination of that two-hour window is not a determination I made. Again, it's a federal interpretive guideline of what a medication error. It dates back to review of wrong time errors in hospitals. In general, most medications are not that time sensitive. So there are some classes of meds that are time sensitive where, based on the half-life of the medication and the time it takes to release it, that that may be important. And the scheduling of medications is actually typically done at the facility. The physician will say 3 times a day, 4 times a day, 2 times a day, some amount of time, generally are not very specific. If that the med, we do know that with our, for instance, our diabetes drugs that are supposed to be taken before meals, that based on Heather Young's study, our aides are very good at getting those meds done before the meals. So there is evidence that if there is information about the time sensitivity or the meal-related sensitivity, that they can follow that instruction, and they actually tend to prioritize that because they believe it's more important.
Thank you. Follow-up, Madam Chair? Thank you. Thank you for the answer. Just as an aside, it sounds like there's a lot of information in the Heather Young study that might be helpful for the committee to consider, and I understand it's not published, but if I'm going to consider it, it would be very helpful for me to be able to read it in its whole context. So if it would be possible to get that to us, that would be helpful. And then the question that goes with that is, in the Heather Young study where she found that timing of medications was not an issue in Oregon, and knowing that some medications are different than others and some medical conditions would have a need for more precise medication schedules than others, did she study actual time for time-sensitive medications, or was it within that federal definition of it's on time as long as it's an hour before or an hour after the scheduled time?
Representative Gelser, I would have to ask Heather Young if she's willing to release the information to the committee. Right now it's embargoed because she's waiting to get it published in a peer-review-related journal, but I would ask her permission if I could provide that information to you. I don't mean to characterize her study to say she did not find wrong time errors. She did find wrong time errors. She did use that 1 hour before and 1 hour after definition, but she found no evidence that any of the wrong time errors were clinically significant, and she had all of her errors reviewed by a panel that included a geriatrician, a nurse practitioner, and somebody else that I don't remember in the panel, a pharmacist.
And just as a follow-up, I completely understand the issue of it being embargoed, but just as someone that's considering the information, it's really impossible for me to consider the information that comes from that study if I can't have the ability to read the study and read the full context. So I know for me personally, I can't consider that information unless I can actually see the study. Other people may feel differently.
And we will try to make arrangements for that. Quick.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question. It doesn't matter to me who answers it. If House Bill 3093 passes, do you anticipate needing additional staff, retraining existing staff, both, or neither?
I think in its present context, the training issues are addressed in the current regulations under the training requirements as is. I think the issue then comes in, as Margaret was, Ms. Carley was addressing, with the potential that, if we focus on the timing piece, we're really not solving the problem or the issue. I don't know if that answers your question.
Absolutely. If I could help, I believe that whether or not it will change practice, it will depend upon the interpretations given to these rights or any additional regulatory language. But it does envision training for every disease state. So we would have, if now 12 or so disease states are represented in the CNA curriculum and there's, I don't know how many diseases, you could obviously see that would be enhanced training hours related to disease states. It also envisions that there's a right, in effect, to timely med management. And again, that's the problem we have as opposed to a safe and effective medication delivery system. If timely is going to be the issue, obviously I think it would require more staff given the volume of meds to meet the time requirement, and we wouldn't necessarily have improved quality outcomes. We would just have a larger portion of our meds on time as opposed to a small portion of time-sensitive ones that need to be done on time. So I think it would increase costs for the system to do these rights, but how much would have to be measured by the rules that came to enforce these rights.
Thank you.
just to further add, Madam Chair and Representative Bonamici, on the Medicare, the diet piece, there could significantly be additional staff required with RDs or further trained dietary folks, particularly in foster homes and assisted living and residential care where those professionals are not required at this time.
Thank you. I was wondering if I see the Board of Pharmacy people back there. Do you have, sorry, Paige, any input on the timing that you'd want to share? And if you'd like to, if you could come up, Lauren, do you mind?
No.
But I do have questions. So if you wouldn't mind saying. And if you could make it quick, you've heard the conversation. I wonder if you have any comments around the timing issue or around.
Thank you. Sure, Kotick. You saw us whispering in the back of the room.
You actually Representative Gelser did. So.
When you whisper in the back of the room, I should have known. It is interesting. For the record, I'm Paige Clark, the consultant pharmacist with the Oregon Board of Pharmacy on staff there. So, and happily, I did spend a number of my years as a consultant pharmacist in long-term care, so we were whispering back there. Certainly, I can understand both perhaps sides of the issue, and there are medications that are absolutely imperative that they be given on time. Our compliance director sitting behind me was back there. I'm holding him in his chair as some of that conversation took place, and that is a crucial issue in some disease states. Absolutely, from a pharmacological standpoint, and that was addressed quite well in testimony, definitely. The practicality of every single medication being delivered in that time frame that you so correctly asked about, that two-hour window is what we in the world of pharmacy live and die by in those med passes. And there is a great sensitivity to the fact that that must happen very within that two-hour time frame, or that is considered a med error. And the question of available dollars, available training time, and is that going to accomplish what needs to be done is an interesting question. And certainly perhaps dividing out therapeutic areas makes a lot of sense and looking at those medications that are absolutely time sensitive. And it's interesting too because the wonderful gentleman whose name I'm terribly sorry I've forgotten who sat here and shared his personal story with us, perhaps medication can even fall within that two-hour time frame, and yet his experience of his medication therapy may be impacted by being at one end or the other end of a two-hour time frame. That would be our input.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks for coming up. Appreciate that. I do have a couple questions, and then we need to move on. So back to the Heather Young study, did she report on an overall error rate in the study?
She did. Actually, just for assisted living facilities. And I have her slides.
Mm-hmm. I'm just curious what it was.
Yeah. Here. Can I give you just a few slides to set it in context? The first is that residents in assisted living in Oregon were taking 9.6 routine meds a day, 3.5 PRN medications for a total of 13.1 different medications per day. She does have information on the number of Medicaids per resident. She actually has 5 states in her study. I was reporting some information on Oregon, but she has Washington and New Jersey as well, and then she's adding 2 additional states. She has information on medication aid training. She has information on her medication observations. She observed 4,802 medications, and she has medication error rates by state with, she's broken them out by types of errors, with wrong dose errors, wrong drug, extra doses, unauthorized dose, and omitted doses, again with wrong time being the most significant portion of the types of errors, but again not clinically significant as it related to wrong time. And she analyzed 402 errors. And
the overall error rate?
I'm just looking at it if I can see.
9.9%
is the overall error rate, as she reports. in Oregon, and she also calculated an error with time medications and without time medications, and overall for her study she was reporting a 29.2% error rate for the states that she has listed: Oregon, Washington, New Jersey, and of those states.
Thank you. With the time.
With, yeah.
That included the time error. If you take out the time errors, it drops down to... Okay. So around 29% with the error time error.
29.2% overall with the time errors, dropping down to 8.3% overall without. And that's actually lower than what's reported in hospitals and nursing homes in the literature, where they did drug observation studies.
Okay, thank you. Well, and I would concur with Rep. Gelser. It would be nice to see the full report, if you're able to share. I understand. Okay. But we have no intention of sharing it with the greater world, so hopefully the Heather Michonne would be okay with that.
Can I just ask a brief interpretation question, or translation question?
Yes.
You mentioned PRN, and I'm sorry, I don't know what's...
I'm sorry, Representative Kotek, Representative Bonamici. PRN are, it's a Latin term. It means as needed, essentially. Okay. I won't give you the Latin terminology.
That's fine.
But, so if you had Tylenol, for instance, and you just needed it as needed for a headache, that would be a PRN medication, as opposed to a scheduled dose. So we
kind of figured out, since I don't speak Latin.
Rep. Flores.
And, Madam Chair, I guess perhaps it might be a question for Committee Administrator, but any information that's provided to us for our bill files, does that information not become public record?
Chair, any information that comes to me personally is public domain. If something's delivered to you by a third party, that's not necessarily public domain.
Yeah, but there was big discussion during the interim about the retention of information that came into our bill file, so that's why it triggered my thought here.
Well, perhaps can I make a suggestion that there's a place where whoever wants to go look at the study can go look at it and not copy it.
Oh, that's an idea.
We could do that.
Or read it.
Or ask Michelle if she could do a summary of the pertinent issues. We don't need to see the whole study, probably, so... But thank you for that. We have to be careful about public documents. So I want to move on, but what I'm hearing is we have bills of rights in statute. For me, they are values that we're putting out there, that these are things we value. And I agree with the argument that this allows folks to advocate for themselves by empowering them with the information that both of you have said that we do in rules and regs. I mean, it's there. We're supposed to be doing these things. So I have a difficult time understanding why this is, frankly, a big deal, other than the fact that there is some assumption that families, patients and their families, folks who are in these facilities will advocate for what they should have. So I guess I need to think some more about, the impact financially, but I look at these things and if this is what we ought to be providing already, and we're just making some value statements in statute, you got to help me out here. Why this is a problem?
Representative Kotek, the problem is that as the department interprets the rights, they add new requirements that are previously not in the regulations, or change the requirement, or change the interpretation of the requirement. I've never seen a statute that they have interpreted where they didn't interpret new requirements, and so the bill requires both regulations and statutes, and any statute is subject to interpretation, but in general, we envision that these changes would be uniformly applied with different regulatory impacts on the different settings depending on the current status of the rule. So, for instance, for assisted living facilities who only do modified special diets.
I'm actually more supportive of it as it's written, because I do think I can see some of the challenges in the different types of facilities, but as it's written now, we're talking about basically the top tier type of facilities who have all the training and should have everything to make these happen, unless I'm missing something.
Representative Kotek, the nursing facilities have the requirements if the medication requirement is interpreted a certain way, it will be a problem for them in terms of complying, and will create counter incentives to safe medication delivery systems.
Thank you for that comment. And I think we probably should hear from the department as well, since I don't know why someone from the department's not here. It'd be good to have their feedback as well. So
we inquired, and they did not plan to testify.
Okay, thank you. And appreciate your time. Thank you for being here. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3093 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 163A. Colleagues, if you remember, we saw 163A in the full committee a week or so ago. It had come out of the Access Subcommittee. We had some questions. And we have some folks here who are here to answer our questions and elaborate, since we didn't have the opportunity in the Access Subcommittee because we're not there to hear some of this. So, hello, gentlemen. So we have Dr. Schaefer. Is it Dr. Pelkey?
John Pelkey.
Just Mr. Pelkey, okay. And you are?
Ralph Summers.
Mr. Summers, great. So whoever wants to go first, identify yourself for the record, please. And we also have Cindy Becker from COHO and on behalf of the Medicaid Managed Care Plans as well. So.
Thank you, Chair Kotek, members of the committee. My name is Walter Schaefer. I'm the Medical Director for the Division of Medical Assistance Programs. And I am here along with my colleagues that we just identified to testify in support of Senate Bill 163, now A, engrossed. I have submitted several things, some written testimony on the part of the department, so I won't go over all the details of the written testimony, but just to make a couple of comments about the why we think this is an important bill and some of the intents and origins of it. The integration of behavioral health care on the one hand and physical health care on the other is one of the highest priorities at this time for the Department of Human Services. And actually a letter was just distributed this week, signed by the division directors of the Division of Medical Assistance Programs, the Public Health Division, and the Addictions and Mental Health Division. This letter notifying all interested parties of the starting of a series of coordinated efforts between the divisions to identify and break down barriers to coordinated unified care. And this year, the department is asking each of the mental health organizations and each of the managed care organizations that provides medical care for Oregon Health Plan clients to develop collaborative projects initiating or advancing combined systems of care. And one of the barriers that we have come up with relates to the exchange of health information barriers in the current statutes, and in particular the policies on mental health records release, that those policies are more restrictive, creating situations at times when where the mental health organizations are reluctant to release patient information to medical plans. So this bill seeks to clarify that the exchange of protected health information is allowed in the specific context of mental health organizations and managed care organizations working together for the same individual. The intent is to clarify that mental health organizations and managed care organizations are healthcare providers, which is not currently clear, not currently specified in the statutes. So the basic process that I would like to go through in my testimony is to look at the current statutes so that you understand that there are circumstances in which release of patient information without specific consent is allowed. It's just that it's not specified that these managed care organizations providing care for Oregon Health Plan clients are covered by these statutes. So the sheet that describes the current laws is titled Protected Health Information, and it starts with 192.518 and goes on for several pages. And what we're really interested in is into it several pages, but if you just look, for example, on page 2 towards the bottom, it lists different types of healthcare providers and includes a lot of mental health providers, psychologists, it includes physicians and other types of providers. But if you just kind of follow over down to the fourth page towards the bottom, fourth page of printing. It's 192.520. It deals with, first of all, some situations where release of protected health information is allowed with authorization. That's number one. Number two deals with disclosure of protected health information without authorization within a provider's treatment healthcare operations. So we're more concerned with number three, which states that under current statutes, providers may disclose protected health information of an individual without obtaining authorization to another covered entity for healthcare operations activities, provided that each entity has or had a relationship with the individual. And healthcare operations are further defined in 192.519, which is the reason I gave you this whole packet is that's back a couple pages. But at the top of page, the second page of printing, healthcare operations is defined, the sections A and B under number four. And so basically that's for purposes of quality assessment, accreditation, auditing, improvement activities, case management, and care coordination. So currently healthcare providers can exchange information without specific individual authorization under those circumstances. Furthermore, if you go back to that page that we were on dealing with the that section that allows the release down to, and this is, well, it's number three in letter B, disclosure is allowed to another covered entity or other healthcare provider for treatment activities of a healthcare provider. So the current statutes are pretty broad. It's just that they don't specifically state that mental health organizations and managed care organizations for the Oregon Health Plan are covered, and so that's the purpose of Senate Bill 163.
So if I could just jump in a second, Dr.
Sure.
Schaefer.
Mm-hmm.
So your understanding is, theoretically, we can do this now without 163.
Yes, we can do it. Healthcare providers can do it now. It's just not clear that the mental health organizations and the managed care plans are kind of a step removed from the providers. So it's not specifically clear that at that level of in the healthcare system that this type of exchange can occur. And we want that type of exchange to occur mainly for planning of where services will be, for monitoring pharmacy programs, for monitoring quality of care. It's and for these collaborative projects between mental health and physical health. We want to clarify that type of exchange is permitted.
Representative Gelsler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate, I know these came to my office earlier today, uh-huh. and it's helpful to see what the current law is, but it's also very alarming. My response is, oh my gosh, we need to change this. This is a problem. Because as I read this, I understand that I could go and see a licensed marriage and family therapist, and that person under this law could communicate with my family physician and communicate any of my medical records without my authorization, even though I believe that the information that I share with my physician is private and the information I share with my marriage and family practice person is private. If they, without me, decide, because they both have or have had at some time in my past, maybe I saw a counselor 10 years ago, they by themselves have decided they need to talk about me, they can exchange information about me without my consent or knowledge under current law.
Chair Kotek, Representative Gelsler. That's true, but there would have to be a legitimate reason why they would exchange that information without consent. They'd have to have some justification, and that would generally be emergency situations, or in case of clinics trying to coordinate care, there may be certain types of information like that that they would want to exchange without specifically getting authorization.
Follow up? I think that my concern is that that determination of whether or not that's a legitimate or necessary purpose would happen as a patient without my consent. If I am in a special population, we heard some testimony about this the other evening in another committee, where someone has maybe been at a mental health facility in the past, they move on to another, they do not want that mental health facility. They will specifically exclude release of information because they don't want anyone communicating with that facility. I think that's their right. As I am a parent of a kid that has some pretty complex medical needs, he has received bad medical treatment and has been harmed by exchange of bad information in the past, which is why, I mean, I now don't allow a release of information between anyone. I sign the release to myself. I study the things before I release them. So I have a real problem with the idea. I mean, I feel very vulnerable. I think people like my child would be very vulnerable, and I think people with mental health conditions would be very vulnerable if there are other people without their consent that these conversations are even taking place, determining for them what is right about their very most personal information. So I have a problem with the bill, and I hope that we can go back and examine our current statute, because I have a real problem with this. This terrifies me. This is very scary. It's very disturbing, and I think puts some populations at a very significant risk.
Madam Chair, Representative Gelser, these policies are difficult because you do have to balance the needs of the healthcare system to provide the best quality of care with the privacy of individual records. But these current statutes are consistent with the federal HIPAA rules and their Oregon's current version of the policies to protect health information. There are more specific rules that govern the release of mental health records, and those are cited in the bill in for section 179.505. And although the current Senate Bill 163 is not going to be in that section, the bill cites a reference to that, to those. And I've made copies of the mental health statutes, although I haven't distributed them, but I could. They're similar in the sense that there are certain circumstances in which mental health records can be released without authorization, but it's more restrictive. But the situation is the same with those. The mental health organizations and managed care organizations of the Oregon Health Plan aren't specified in the rules or in the statute. So it's the bill, again, means that those protections on mental health records are still in place, but within those protections, the Oregon Health Plan prepaid health organizations can exchange information.
Representative Bonamici has a
question. Thank you, Madam Chair. Any of you can answer this, I hope. In Representative Gelser's example about not wanting the information to go from one place to the other, and specifically saying she didn't want, and you said that could happen under existing circumstances if there is a reason or an emergency. Where can I find the standards by which that decision is made? What qualifies as emergency or circumstances under which that communication can be made?
Madam Chair and Representative Bonamici, the basis of the Oregon rules are the federal HIPAA regulations, so I guess we would need to review those, but I think that's where a lot of the basis comes from. Any other comments? Sure.
Mm-hmm. Identify yourself.
Yeah, my name is Ralph Summers. I'm the Medicaid Policy Manager for the Department of Human Services Addictions and Mental Health Division, Chair Kotek, members of the committee. The section that the doctor identified, 179.505, has particular protections on psychotherapy notes that may not be disclosed without specific client authorization, and that's a higher level of protection than the federal privacy guidelines that are in federal law. And the bill that we're going to talk about doesn't seek to change those protections on psychotherapy notes. It simply seeks to clarify that the plans that the state's Medicaid program contracts with to help manage Medicaid-funded services can have the ability to review billing records and patient-level identifying information that's already in data systems to do planning for how better to serve their members. But the specific protections that are in statutes about not releasing mental health records that have the kind of content that the provider jots down what was discussed and those kinds of things, we don't seek to change those protections. They're currently important.
And follow up?
Mm-hmm. And how broad, you mentioned psychotherapy notes, but how broad is that? Because I don't think that's just what we're talking about. I don't think that's just what the concern is about psychotherapy notes. I think it's about more than that.
Sorry.
Madam Chair, Representative Bonamici, I can read the definition of psychotherapy notes, but I think you're right. The concerns are broader, but in the 179505, psychotherapy notes means notes recorded in any medium by a mental health professional in the performance of the official duties of the mental health professional, documenting or analyzing the contents of conversation during a counseling session, and that are maintained separately from the rest of the individual's records. But psychotherapy notes don't include medication prescription, results of clinical tests, diagnosis, treatment plan, that sort of thing. So those don't have these special protections that the psychotherapy notes have.
Thank you. Representative Flores?
Thank you. So as I understood you to say, the specific psychotherapy notes would not include diagnosis, prescription requirements and other things, and sometimes those are pretty revealing because that would be information that would be moving forward without the authorization. Is that correct?
That's correct. Your interpretation is correct.
I guess I want to give Mr. Pelkey a chance to.
Yes.
Since you're up there, I assume you wanted to say a few points. I'm sure we have more questions, but I just want to make sure you got it.
Chair, Representative Kotek, members of the committee, I'll keep my comments fairly brief. I am John Pelkey, for the record, Quality Improvement and Medical Section Manager for the Division of Medical Assistance Programs, and I am in here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 163. As Dr. Schaefer has indicated in his testimony, we are interested in promoting the integrated care in order to improve health outcomes and to develop that integrated patient care delivery system we would like to see. There is a priority within the Department of Human Services and also from the Governor's Mental Health Task Force to foster integration of behavioral health and physical health care. And this legislation really does remove a current barrier to creating a seamless system of primary care for physical and mental health. I would say that exchange of aggregated data on diagnosis and treatment is necessary in the new approaches to collaborative care. And I would, so a point to be made is that it's critical in terms of clinical quality performance improvement effort. Each of us, I believe, must be dedicated to achieving clinical quality second to none and customer service excellence for our clients and patients. And clinical quality performance improvement really requires having that data, the data-driven decisions, which will directly help those clinical quality performance efforts. Clinical quality performance improvement is a focus within the Division of Medical Assistance Programs, and this legislation does support that effort. A good example that I would provide to the committee is that connection between heart disease and depression and mental health. It's now recognized that patients who have depression or mental health symptoms are also at elevated risk for heart disease or other cardiac problems. And conversely, those patients with cardiac or heart disease problems or have had heart surgery, they are at elevated risk
for mental health issues and depression. So those two systems, really, the mental health providers on the one hand and the cardiologists and the cardiac surgeons, those that provide cardiac services, both need to really recognize that connection and work in collaboration for improvement of a healthcare system which would serve both the mental health and physical health needs of the person. So SB 163 is an important step, we see, to support this effort to promote integrated healthcare, to improve health outcomes, and really treat the whole person as part of that patient-centered delivery system. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Pelkey. And before I take questions, if I could, I'd like an explanation of the authorization form very briefly. I think we understand the intent, and I appreciate the reiteration of that. I think you're guessing we have other questions other than the intent. So, but could you explain
yes,
the authorization form? That would be helpful.
Chair Kotek, the other two sheets that you have, one is the notice of privacy practices, and this is page 12 of the Oregon Health Plan booklet that applicants to the Oregon Health Plan receive and read. And so it specifies that the Department of Human Services may use and disclose health information without your authorization under the three circumstances listed in the middle for treatment with healthcare providers who are involved in your healthcare, and for payment, and for healthcare operations. DHS may disclose protected health information in order to manage its programs and activities. That understanding is included, understanding by clients is included then in the second sheet, which is the signature sheet for the application for the Oregon Health Plan. And it says by signing this application, makes reference about a third of the way down to the notice of privacy practices. But then three bullets further down, it says, I allow the department to share the healthcare records of myself and anyone I apply for with other DHS agencies and department contractors and their providers. And it certainly could be argued that most of the OHP applicants would not have a clue as to what they're signing by what that means, but nonetheless, they are in applying to the Oregon Health Plan. At least they've given some authorization for the type of exchange of information that the bill is seeking clarification on.
Thank you. I'm glad you brought this. So, Representative Gelson.
Thank you. I wanted to say I don't have a problem with the intent, and I mean I think everybody wants to see integrated mental health and physical health care, whether that's depression and heart disease or anything else. However, I think that there is a simple remedy to that, which is called a release of information. The patient signs it; they're part of that decision, and they continue to own their own information about their own bodies, about their own health. Someone else isn't deciding for them. I just can't imagine it's that hard to do an authorization and a notice, and then you've got coordinated care. And so I'm much more comfortable having that happen and having people know this kind of information is being exchanged about them between people.
Thank you. And without, if I'm in the interest of time, I wanted to make sure that Cindy Becker gets a chance to say a few words, and then I'm going to have to close the public hearing. Are there any final questions? Representative Bonamici, you have a...
Well, I have a... I think Representative Gelser was getting to the point I was about to make but didn't quite turn it into a question, in that why can't you just get the consent? This says without obtaining an authorization. Why can't you get the authorization? Then you'll have the authorization, and people like Representative Gelser may handle it differently than other people, and I think she's saying that that's the right she should have.
Madam Chair and Representative Bonamici, there are basically three types of situations, three types of information where it would be difficult or impossible to obtain specific consent. One is with the exchange of aggregated data.
Could you define what you're talking about when you say?
Yes. And that's mental health organization may have data that tells how many people with schizophrenia are or depression
are treated at Clinic A, Clinic B, Clinic C. On the medical care side, the managed care organization may have information on how many people with heart disease and depression diagnoses are seen at Clinic A, Clinic or Clinic X, Clinic Y, and Clinic Z. And when they're trying to coordinate care and decide where services are needed, for example, where a mental health provider may be needed in a physical health clinic, they need to exchange that type of information. And it's not clear from the current statutes that they can exchange that type of information for planning and collaboration.
That doesn't seem to be... Right, that should be anonymous, right? You just want... I don't see that is the issue that we're concerned about. If you want to know how many heart patients are at a particular clinic or how many... That doesn't need to be associated with it.
Right, but that's one of the barriers that currently exists. Those organizations can't exchange that type of information. That's one of the reasons that we need the bill.
So in that case, we've had entirely too much experience with medical systems. OHSU recently had to send out kind of reverse permission slips for those of us that are fortunate enough to have our nuclear pellets of genetic material stored there, where if you did not want that used for research, even though it would be non-identifying, you signed it and you sent it back. If you didn't send it back, then it was a lack of consent. Why couldn't you do something like that for aggregated data, kind of a reverse opt-out?
Chair Kotek, Representative Gelser, that is possible, but it would be it would have an inhibitory effect on the types of exchange of information and make it more difficult, so that if that type of requirement of notification after the fact or opt-out provision, if we tried to add that to the current bill, it would probably make it more restrictive than the current statutes. So, I don't think that it would be helpful to the seamless kind of healthcare system that we're trying to create to have those types of barriers. The specific mailing that OHSU had to do, I think, related to a particular situation, particular type of bill that was mandated, where they had to give people the option in that type of case. But that was a special case.
If I can, I'd like to bring Cindy. Do you want to say a few words? Because in the interest of time, folks in the Board of Pharmacy have been very patient. We need to work session their bill here, so. And we do need to leave by 5. So,
thank you, Cindy. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cindy Becker, and I am the executive director of COHO, not the salmon, the Coalition for Healthy Oregon, which represents Medicaid managed care plans, 11 of the 14 managed care plans in the state. What I have asked staff to give you is a letter from Jim Russell, who is the head of the Mid-Valley Behavioral Health Network, testimony that he gave on March 14th in support of this bill. We are 100% in support of this bill. And basically, as everyone has talked about, is the desire to have an integrated system. I think that one of the bases for having an integrated system is you have to be able to share information. What Dr. Schaefer gave you is current state law, and it covers a whole lot more than the topic that we're talking about today. What we're trying to do is clarify for the mental health organizations and the fully capitated health plans that they are allowed to share information. The current state law applies to everybody. It's been in effect for a number of years. I don't know that we've had wholesale problems. There may be individual problems. I clearly understand that. But what we're talking about are folks who are both are treating the same individual, wanting to be able to share information for the care and the coordination of that individual. There could be circumstances, for example, there's an emergency circumstances, a medication issue. We have clinicians on the one hand prescribing medications that other clinicians who are working with this individual may know nothing about. There's not an intent to subvert anything here. All we're trying to do is add this group, which is consistent with every other category, long list of services that is currently acceptable in the state, to just make it clear there's been some confusion and there is a higher standard around mental health, as it should be. But this is to eliminate some of the confusion. Again, we're trying to provide coordinated, better care for individuals. And both the mental health organizations and the managed care plans are trying to work together, but if you can't share information, it's really difficult to go very far to work together. There's not an intent to share information with anyone else besides those individuals that are both treating the patient. So it's not going to be information that's going to be shared with all the other care plans or anyone else. These are both two plans that are sharing information. For example, if you are served by Kaiser, your information is shared all over Kaiser. They don't have stop gaps and say, well, your information, mental health information can't be shared by somebody else who works in Kaiser. That entire system, they have access to your records. We're talking about a structural issue here where there are two providers, they're separate providers, providing the same services that a Kaiser might, but they're just separate providers being able to share information. I don't know if that's helpful.
Quick questions. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you. And I agree with everything you said. My question is, why can't you do that with consent?
Why can't you have them agree that their providers will be able to share information? That's what I'm struggling with.
Representative Kotek and Representative Bonamici, it's not that they're trying not to get it, but there may be circumstances where they don't. And this allows the exchange of information in those circumstances where they don't. And I can't tell you what those are, but I don't believe that anyone's trying to hold back getting that, but there are situations where that information, where that consent is not given, just like it is for any other of these medical or mental health service areas that are currently in statute. There are going to be circumstances where that consent doesn't happen for whatever reason. But I don't think it's anyone's intent on any of these providers here to not give it. For example, when I go to the doctor, the first thing I get, you know, when I go to a new doctor, as you do, I know, is a request to sign a consent form. And nothing in that is going to change. But there are circumstances, for whatever reason, that it doesn't happen. And this just allows the sharing of that information, again, for the treatment of those people, for those individuals.
Well, it might make sense. Maybe we have to create the mechanism that, in all other things exhausted, then you can do this and that. Maybe that's, I don't know. Representative Bruin, Representative Gelser, and then we need to get to 200.
Thank you, Madam Chair, very much. As it sits right now, with all the state health programs, however you want to describe it, that this bill would affect and benefit per the argument today, are they all at this point consistent on their medical information systems, i.e., with electronic? Well, you're shaking your head. No. Then my question is, what benefit are we really going to get from this? Because that's the real crux of the issue in my mind. You talk about Kaiser. In my opinion, Kaiser works. Yeah, sure, information is shared, but they also have the same systems, and that's what makes it so beneficial. You say we're going to share the information, but then we don't have a system that actually can reciprocate the sharing of that information. It seems to me like we're sort of potentially giving up some stuff as far as record safety, however you want to look at that, privacy, and we're not really gaining anything from a cost or effectiveness standpoint.
Representative Kotek, Representative Bruin, the whole area of electronic medical health records, as you know, is evolving, and the providers, more and more of them across the state, are investing in that. I think it's just a matter of time before all of the providers have that and have that capability. But again, we're really talking about two different levels here. One is the ability to aggregate information, as Dr. Schaefer was talking about, which right now, because there's not explicit language in statute that says mental health organizations and managed care organizations, there is a reticence on the part of and mental health organizations they want to make sure that it's legal for them to share the information on the aggregate level. The other issue is around the specific treatment to make sure there's a coordinated treatment for individuals. And again, this is allowed across the state for all these other disciplines. We're just trying to clarify that what is allowed for all these other areas is also allowed here. We're just trying to add that one area.
Mr. Summers. Identify
Thank you. Ralph Summers, DHS Addictions and Mental Health. I'd like to, Chair Kotek, Representative Brunn, I'd like to respond to your question about data systems. All of the various Medicaid managed care plans report data to the Department of Human Services in standardized federally mandated formats. And so enrollment information and service information about the types of services that were delivered and diagnoses and that kind of thing is all standardized. So the kind of information that plans need to share for some planned quality improvement kinds of approaches in order to make sure that the patients that need their care managed the most get the primary care and the mental health people to jointly plan on a population based, that data is available and it's standardized across all the plan types. It doesn't take standard electronic records to do that.
So DHS already gets that information?
That's correct. And before, Chair, before we had managed care plans, the Department of Human Services could engage in these activities. But as we know, that the ability to coordinate and improve care, the closer you get to the patients, the more effective those things are. And now that we contract with 13 medical plans and 9 regional mental health plans, we're trying to get those plans to be able to engage in the kind of population-based planning that the state in the past has engaged in. And in order to engage in that planning, they need to be able to share data about their members, the kinds of diseases that their members have, and the kinds of utilization patterns that their members have.
Thank you. Last question, then we need to close up.
Thank you. If this bill were to pass, and granted that people will try to get authorization where they can or consent, what protection is there for someone that, for whatever reason, it's up to them, doesn't want that information exchanged? What protection would they have to be able to protect their information? And if they didn't want their family physician talking to their psychiatrist or their psychologist or their cardiologist, what protection would they have to not have that information exchanged between parties?
To be honest with you, Representative Delser, I can't tell you what protection they would have because if the provider is providing that information in accordance with state and federal law, they're probably the family could certainly file a complaint, or the individual could file a complaint, but if the provider were providing that within federal and state law, I'm not sure what recourse they would have.
So just to follow up to clarify. So if this law passed, and actually under current statute, people have no rights to say, I don't want my information exchanged between practitioners, and even if I explicitly say that, it doesn't matter because state and federal law says it doesn't matter whether or not I want that information exchanged. They get to do that anyway without my consent, even if I explicitly deny the consent.
Representative Gelser, go ahead. I'm not a lawyer, and I don't know what would happen in that situation.
I think we might have to ask for some legal expertise on that issue. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to close the public hearing because we need to hear this other bill and get going. So, but I want to thank you for being here and answering our questions, coming back and trying to address our concerns. We're going to talk among the committee. We'll figure out how we want to move forward on this. And just thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
With that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 163 and open a work session on Senate Bill 200. And thank you, Board of Pharmacy folks, for your patience. Did we pass the Dash 1 amendment last time?
We did.
So we have Senate Bill 200 as amended with the Dash 1s, which dealt with primarily the drug outlet and the different. It was the Senator George's amendment there.
Correct.
So Representative Flores or Bonamici, do you want to update us?
You two were working on this, right?
That's right.
Well, okay. What happened was once we decided to work on it, I received a message, and the issue was the cost provision. There was an attorney here who had some concerns about the Administrative Procedures Act,
and the lack of specificity in the statute about that. And we were going to have a work group, and the next thing I knew was I got a message from the Board of Pharmacy that they don't want to hold up the bill to do that. They just assume delete that provision and keep moving on ahead with the bill. So the dash two amendments delete that provision, which is on, it starts on the front page, you can see, and goes at line 27. Through 29, and then on the back, the top of the first line, disciplined, and then it just renumbers the provision. So there in fact was no work group.
And we do good work.
That's right.
Aren't we work representatives?
So at this point, I move the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 200.
Representative Bonamici has moved the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 200. Would the Board of Pharmacy like anything on the record regarding the dash twos? No, you're good. Okay. So any other discussion around the dash twos, Representative?
Just a quick question. So I'm trying to recollect. Representative Flores said we did pass the dash one. So basically then the only thing this bill does, if we're deleting 27 through 29, is add the $1,000 for offense for each for an offense committed by an individual, and $10,000 for an offense committed by a drug outlet, and that's effectively the only thing the bill does. Is that incorrect?
Well, and then there's also on page 2, line 12, adding the word penalty.
Right.
The continuing jurisdiction issue.
Right.
Okay. That remains.
Exactly.
Thank you. Clarification from the
Dollar.
Thank you. So.
And then I have a procedural question. Do we need to send this back to the full committee now?
Yes. 200? Well, it hasn't gone to the full committee.
Well, we moved it to the full committee.
It's come back.
Okay. Okay. So right now, the motion on the table is amending Senate Bill 200 with the dash two amendments. All those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? Seeing none, we've amended with the dash twos. So right now what we have is Senate Bill 200 amended with the dash 1 and dash 2. I'll entertain a motion to move the bill.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 200 as amended with the dash 1 and dash 2 amendments to the full health care committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Bonamici. The motion is to move Senate Bill 200 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Erin, would you call the roll?
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative
Gilbert.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Bonamici.
Aye.
Vice Chair Bruin.
Aye.
Chair
Potek. Aye. And with that, Senate Bill 200 as amended, we'll move on to the full committee. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Board of Pharmacy. We need a carrier, Representative Bonamici. Thank you very much. Carrier to the full committee. And with that, we will close the work session on Senate Bill 200, and the committee is...